Today's Keisho will be on Case 53, Yakujo and a Wild Duck. Engo's introduction. The universe is not veiled. All its activities lie in the open. Whichever way he goes, he meets no obstruction. At all times, he behaves independently. His every word is devoid of egocentricity, yet still has the power to kill others. Tell me, where did the ancient worthy come to rest? See the following. Main subject. When Ba Daishi was out walking with Yakujo, he saw a wild duck fly past. Daishi said, "What is it?" Yakujo said, "It is a wild duck." Daishi said, "Where is it?" Yakujo said, "It's flown away." Daishi at last gave Yakujo's nose a sharp pinch. Yakujo cried out with pain. Daishi said, "There, how can it fly away?" Secho's verse, the wild duck. What, how, and where? Basso has seen, talked, taught, and exhausted the meaning of mountain clouds and moonlight seas, but Joe doesn't understand, has flown away. Flown away, no, he's brought back, say. I want to thank you all very much for coming to practice Zazen on this wonderful, wonderful Saturday morning. Beautiful spring morning. And sitting so deeply. Everybody's sitting so still. Thank you. It's a pleasure to practice with you. You know, we've been through a difficult year. I think that's fair to say. About a year ago at this time, we decided to go online because we could no longer meet in person. And since then, I'm sorry to say that, you know, more than 500,000 people in our country have died. And, you know, the economy cratered. Many things happened that were very challenging. And, you know, I know people who have been directly affected by this. You know, as I mentioned, there's people in my neighborhood that I know. We've lost to COVID. People in my department at Rutgers lost to COVID, and you know, I've known a number of people who lost jobs. In fact, one of my very good friends, her husband lost his job after 25 years, and then her boss lost his job. So that's scary, right? Lots of people are in that situation. And it's very difficult when things like that happen to you, not to take it personally. I have mentioned this before, but I remember it stuck with me because it's so striking. You know, in the 1930s in the United States, in 1929 in the United States, the economy collapsed. It absolutely collapsed. And it was in a very short period of time. The stock market crashed, and then it crashed again. What we would say now are billions of dollars evaporated overnight. And people went from being, you know, middle class people or even wealthy people to having literally nothing. There was no Social Security. There was no unemployment insurance. And so people could find themselves literally homeless overnight. And of course, this still happens to I just had a chance to see Nomadland, that wonderful movie If you haven't seen it, it's quite powerful. So these things still happen to people, right? You know. But at any rate, you know, the interesting thing was that the entire economy collapsed, and it took almost a decade for us to recover. People who were hardworking, diligent, thrifty, and so on, found themselves living on the street. And these sociologists did studies. They did like a survey of people who had lost their jobs. And they found that most of the people, and almost a quarter of the United States, was out of work overnight. Almost the great majority of the men, mostly at that time, they were mostly men, felt they had failed personally, even though it was a disaster for the whole country. The people who had lost their jobs felt it was a personal failure on their part. In other words, they internalized it as a defect of their own instead of, you know, being able to see the situation honestly as system-wide failure that was indiscriminate in who it affected. I have been reading lately about this downturn and how this time, instead of affecting men, it's very heavily affected women. Women with, you know, advanced degrees and all kinds of special skills, including lawyers and nurses and doctors, even find themselves unable. You know, they have to give up their jobs or their jobs evaporated. Many of them have been unable to continue their jobs because their husband's job is in peril, and there's no school, so somebody has to educate the children, and so on. So this time it's I have talked to people who are in this situation, who have children at home, and they've actually put their jobs on hold. There's a couple of people I know. There's one in my neighborhood who's a good friend of my wife. And she's suffered a great deal because she's put her career on hold. She has to educate her children. She has to be the teacher. They decided this was the way they had to go. And I think she feels personally responsible for the situation. That's such a human response to these events. But it's very important, I believe, to not personalize it in that way. In fact, I would say don't personalize anything, actually. Don't personalize anything. You know, we have a study group, and we've been reading the Platform Sutra of Wei Neng. And it is a magnificent achievement. We've been arguing a bit over what it means and what version of the sutra we should be reading, which is a healthy thing to discuss. But, one of the things Wei Neng says is that, Wei Neng makes a distinction between what he calls blessings and the other term was like, Keith, do you recall?
Merit.
Merit, thank you. Okay, good, merit. Okay, thanks. Okay, so blessings mean something like this. If you work extra hard at your job and the boss happens to notice it, right, and comes in and says, Susan, you've been working extra hard at your job. I see you here every night, and the reports you do are so good. You know, I'm going to give you a raise. See, that's a blessing, right? Or if you take care of somebody who's old and sick, and then when they die, you know, you get a letter saying, please come to the reading of the will. And you come to the reading of the will, and it turns out that they've left you their estate or something. You didn't know, you know, that's a blessing. But merit is very different. Merit means it is what you could say allows us to encounter our true nature. Merit is what it allows us to encounter our true nature. So, you know, the thing is that blessings belong to the realm of causes and conditions, what's called in the sutras causes and conditions. And causes and conditions are really not in our control, right? They're like, if you think about the world as a complex system with lots of moving parts, you know, lots of moving parts, and inside the moving parts are moving parts. And it's all operating, or it's all turning like a big wheel, you know. How things unfold in time is a matter of cause and effect, or karma. And karma means cause and effect, you could say. So, you know, if you're working late at night, and your boss doesn't see you working late at night, then you don't get the raise, right? You don't get the praise, and you don't get the raise. If your boss is so egotistical that he takes credit for everything that happens in his office, and he never turns and looks around and says, my gosh, everybody makes a contribution, that's causes and conditions. And, you know, you might have a boss who's sensitive and intelligent, and he's leaving for the day, and he sees you plugging away, and he identifies with you. And he says, now, that's somebody who really cares about the job. See, how wonderful that is. But you can't guarantee that you'll have that boss, right? It's not in your control. In most cases, people don't get to vote for their bosses, right? So it may be the case, that you have a boss like that. And it may be the case that you have a boss who's an egomaniac, and he doesn't even notice you're working, because he's going out the door, he's saying, I'm master of the universe, I'm a super genius, you know, thank God I can keep these people who work for me on the right track, because they're all unreliable. So that person doesn't give you the praise, it doesn't give you the raise, and you can't control that situation, right? So, you know, in a way, Wei Neng is saying, you know, blessings are nice. They're produced by the actions that happen in this complex system we call the world, right? And, you know, sometimes things work out the way we want, and sometimes they don't. But the system is too big and too complicated for us as individuals to control. And it's not fair. It's not rational. You know, so why did President Trump become president? You know, I certainly didn't vote for him, and I'm pretty confident nobody here today voted for him. So how did he become president? Well, there's a lot of issues, unresolved problems in our culture and in our society. And these issues and problems were sort of like repressed or unaddressed, but simmering under the surface. And I would say that after we elected an African-American president, we created a kind of crisis or trauma for people who are maybe uncomfortable with diversity and so on. And they responded to this crisis or trauma by electing Mr. Trump. And, you know, this is like, if you think of the United States as like a collective consciousness, you know, Trump was sort of buried in there, and he comes out, he came out, and he, you know, in a way, he had to come out. Trump had to be president, because this stuff is in our culture, it's in our world, right? And one way to think about it is, terrible as Trump was, you know, he's allowing us to recognize things about our society and maybe even about ourselves that we didn't see before. And many people suffered. Half a million people have died because of his carelessness and indifference to human life. And so a lot of pain, a lot of suffering produced by this person who maybe had to happen. You know, and so this is like the working out of like collective karma, you can say, right? You know, a lot of racism in our society, a lot of arrogance, a lot of selfishness, a lot of psychopathic egotism, right, or narcissism. And he expressed it. He embodied it and brought it out into the open. And brought these bad consequences, but I think it had to happen. And, you know, you wouldn't have, I think, Joe Biden, our current president, I would say, if you hadn't had Trump. You know, Biden has put forward ideas that wouldn't have been acceptable 5 or 6 years ago. It's like a learning process that we have to go through as a culture, and hopefully we'll learn quickly, right? So none of this is controllable by us, right? We go to the polls, we cast our vote, we could send money to a political party, but this is a big machine that we can't control. And sometimes we get a raise and sometimes we don't. And sometimes we lose our jobs and sometimes we don't. And if you internalize it, if you think that this is something you can control, that's a fantasy, right? It's a fantasy. And yet we do. We internalize these things. We pretend, you could say, that we control things as a way of reassuring ourselves that we're not powerless and helpless. But Wayne Eng says, don't do that. You know, don't do that. Even the good things, don't even think of the good things as deserved, and don't think of the bad things as deserved. Blessings are nice, you know. It's nice to get a raise. It's nice to get a letter of recognition. It's nice to get whatever. You know, those are blessings. But blessings are dependent on causes and conditions. You know, that's not liberating. It's not liberating to believe that if you get that raise, you'll be a better person. Or if you make that breakthrough in your field, your existence is finally worthwhile. That's not liberating, Wayne Eng says. He says that's the realm of causes and conditions. And if you live exclusively in the realm of causes and conditions, you will be weeping at every time the stock market goes up, you'll be happy, and every time the stock market goes down, you'll be weeping. And it's totally like, life is totally like that. It's like in Buddhism, there's this emblem of the wheel, the burning wheel. You know, we're all on the burning wheel. Sometimes the wheel is up, sometimes the wheel is down. And this is life, you know. I think all of us have had moments where you're just thinking it can't get any better than this, right? And then, you know, two years later, there's a moment where you're thinking, oh, this is so undeserved, and it probably is undeserved. You know, both of them are, in a certain sense, undeserved. So this is very different from the way we normally think about things. You know, in the United States especially, we're told that each person, it controls his or her own destiny, right? And that basically if we have, say, positive thoughts, good things will come to us. And this is deeply ingrained in the American character, this idea that if we just do the right thing, we will be rewarded for it. Right? Even though history shows that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. You know, I was just reading something about Abraham Lincoln, you know, who was a great leader. And the persons pointed out that Lincoln went out of his way at the end of the Civil War to be generous with the South, and a person from the South assassinated him, right? You know. So Lincoln didn't get what he deserved, right? He did what he thought was right, but there wasn't any kind, for him personally, there wasn't any kind of payback. See, so Weinang knows all of this. You know, Weinang says, understand that the ways of the world are not predictable and not reliable, and also not just. And so he says, basically, don't count on blessings. So don't count on blessings. Don't take blessings as a sign that you're a good person, even. And in America, we do that regularly. Okay. So I want to talk. I've been reading this book lately. It's a wonderful book of poems by a poet named Liu Sun Wang. Liu Sun Wang. And Liu Sun Wang is a great poet. He's a fantastic poet. And I just wanted to read you just a little bit, not a poem, but about his life. Hold on just a second. Well, the marker fell out. Let me see. Just one moment. Anyway, Liu was a very bright young man, and his father was a administrator who died when he was a child, and his mother raised him and educated him in their home. And he was precocious. He was like very brilliant person, and he went like many members in the Liu family to sit for the imperial exam. And if you finished the imperial exam, you would be part of government service. So you'd be a leader of the country. And all of these young men in China who were from a certain class were educated to be leaders of the country. And they thought it was their moral responsibility to do so. And, you know, the exams went on for days and days, and they involved knowledge of history, ability to write poetry, and so on, cultural knowledge, political knowledge, quite extensive exams. And even though he was a super genius, he took the exam, according to the records, he sat for the exam and failed because the examiner was an enemy of his father. So this is a political system, right? The man who was administering the exams that year was a political opponent of his father. So when Liu took the exam, he failed. And then, according to the account that I was reading, when he took the exam again, he failed again. And then when he took the exam a third time, he failed again. Right? So finally, the enemy of his father was no longer administering the exam because he himself fell from power. And then when Liu took the exam for the fourth time, he got like the highest marks. Right? Got the highest marks. So he was part of a contingent at the imperial court that wanted to reform the government. And they were all young idealists who deeply believed in public service, actually. And they were very upset about the corruption at the court. And the young emperor, was leading this group of reformers who were going to transform the political system. But the young emperor lost in his effort to do this, and he was removed. And corrupt people came back into power, and Liu was sent out into a remote region in the southwest, you know, to waste his talents, right? And he wrote, while he was out in the southwest, this incredible poetry and beautiful essays. And he was waiting to be recalled to the capital, and return to his government work, which he saw as his mission. And he never got to do it. He was there for 15 years. There were all these power struggles, and when he finally got called back, the reformers came back into power. They called him back. And he came to the capital, but he died like a year later. So if you look at his life, you can say, where's the justice in this, right? This guy was such a good man. He was like totally dedicated to helping China, right? And he was a completely, he was both a Confucianist and a Buddhist. And he has some beautiful poems about staying in Buddhist temples. They're incredibly beautiful. But he was an honest, hardworking, decent person, and he didn't get a break, right? He was discriminated against in the exams. The thing is, why am I talking about this guy? Well, I'm amazed that he wasn't, you know, most of us, if we sat for the GRE or the SAT, and we took it four times and we failed it four times, most of us would say, oh man, you know, I'm just no good. You know, probably after, like, I would have stopped after the first time. If I had failed the imperial exam, I would have said, oh man, I knew I was no good. You know, I'm going to go ahead and make straw sandals for the rest of my life or something like that, you know. But somehow Liu had this, had confidence. You know, he wasn't knocked down by circumstances, by causes and conditions which he couldn't control. He didn't internalize them. So he eventually passed his exam on like the fourth try. And probably each of his exams were brilliant. You know, he was discriminated against. And by the way, he was in this little rural part of China where actually there was a kind of slavery going on, where if you were a peasant and you were deeply in debt, sometimes you would sell your daughter or your son. And Liu was such a man such a just and good man. One of the things he did while he was a minor official in this part of China was buy back he bought back 1,000 children and restored them to freedom. So here's a person who's been disappointed in life over and over again, able to do really wonderful things. He's one of a great, I would say he's one of the world's greatest poets and writers, you know. But also, you know, a man of great integrity, person of great integrity who made the world a better place. Yet he, you know, couldn't catch a break a lot of the time. Why didn't he just give up? See, why didn't he just say, oh, it's me, I'm the problem? Like the people we were talking about earlier in the Great Depression who lost their jobs and said, oh, I must be a loser, I'm out of work, right? So I think it's very important not to believe in causes and conditions, not to let them define who we are. You know, in Japan, they have these wonderful dolls. If you go to Japan, you'll see them in every little shop, or you're used to, at least, you know, in the old days. They're called Daruma dolls, Daruma dolls. And Daruma dolls are actually, believe it or not, they're these weird, you know, for Americans, they're sort of these weird little, they look like Russian dolls with, you know, but they're Bodhidharma, believe it or not. And they have no legs, so they roll back and forth, you know. And you can push them all the way down, and they immediately come back up. See, like, you know, they're like roly-poly dolls. And after a big political event, sometimes they, one eye is filled in and the other eye is not painted, and you can put the other, you know, the winning candidate puts the eye in Daruma sometimes. But, you know, this is actually a deep teaching because, you know, Bodhidharma also didn't believe in causes and conditions. You know, when he went to China and met Emperor Wu of Liang, he had a chance to have an interview with somebody who could have helped him a lot to establish Chan in China. And, you know, the interview was a big failure. They didn't understand each other, and Bodhidharma left. But, you know, Bodhidharma didn't go, oh, I knew it was me. I knew, you know, he didn't internalize the event. He didn't personalize the event. He understood these are just causes and conditions. You know, I have students in my class. I'll have a class of 22 students, and I will come in and I'll say something. And four of the students are staring out the window. Four of the students are thinking about lunch or spring break, right? Two of the students turn to me and look at me like I've just said something amazing, right? You know, and some of them are sort of puzzled, right? So, you know, I could say, oh, only two students really understood me. I'm a bad teacher, right? But, you know, that's causes, and you can do your best. Please plan your lesson. Please make an effort to communicate clearly. Try to make it interesting. But there's so much you can't control. You know, I had a student this semester who was my best student. And she was, I'd be grading papers, and I'd suddenly, you know, some of these papers are not very good, you know. So I'm grading a paper, it's like, oh man. And then I'll get to her paper, and it's like, oh, this woman is a genius, you know, she's going to go. So, you know, she quit my class, and I wrote her. I actually wrote her, and I said, what are you doing? You know, why are you leaving my class? And she said, her mother has COVID, and she's got to leave, you know, it had nothing to do with me, right? But I could easily, if I hadn't written her, I could think, oh man, you know, I just lost my best student. You know, what kind of teacher am I, right? I mean, I wouldn't have done that in this case, but it's easy to do that. You know, Bodhidharma is saying, don't let yourself think that way, right? Don't think that way. All of this is, who signs up for your class? You know, sometimes they pick your class because it's later in the day and they don't have to get up early, you know? So it's not necessarily because they're fascinated by the subject matter, right? You know, my point is that we tend, because we're afraid of not being in control, we tend to imagine that we're like masters of our own fate. And that's drilled into our heads as Americans. But it's not true. It's not true. You know, and we should, and Wayne Eng says, don't believe it. Don't believe it. He says, don't think that way. You know, good people lose. Good people get sent into the countryside as punishment for being reformers. You know, Biden could have lost the election. That's causes and conditions too. And he might not be successful because of the opposition. So since we can't control causes and conditions, what are we supposed to do? See, what are we supposed to do? When Ba Dai Shi, that's Baso or Matsu, when Matsu was out walking with Gakujo, Obaku, he saw a wild duck fly past. Matsu said, what is it? Obaku said, it's a wild duck. Matsu said, where is it? Obaku said, it's flown away. Matsu at last gave Obaku's nose a sharp pinch. Says, there's something that doesn't fly away. There's something that moves and there's something that doesn't move. There's something that is always here. Always here. What moves is in the realm of causes and conditions. But when we sit down on the cushion and we do zazen, when we do chan, we are turning our attention away from causes and conditions, and we're turning our attention towards what doesn't move. The Dharmakaya, Buddha nature. Buddha nature. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, your thoughts are like spinning and spinning. But every once in a while, you get to this place that's quiet and calm. And the more you go to that place that's quiet and calm, the deeper it becomes. And, you know, one way we experience that quiet, calm, and unmoving place is as emptiness, as shunyata. Shunyata, mu shin, that is like the door into the unmoving, the door into Buddha nature, mu shin. And as we do more and more meditation, we get closer and closer and closer to that unmoving place. Now, our relationship to that unmoving place requires a transformation in ourselves. So if we're attached to causes and conditions, we don't pay attention to what doesn't move. See? So, you know, if I come into the Zendo and I sit down on the cushion and I just keep thinking about, something at work, first of all, I don't solve the problem. I just sit there and obsess, right? And cause more anxiety. But I'm not I'm not changing my consciousness in any way that's going to be helpful to me. So, you know, when we have something that bothers us and we sit down on the cushion, it's very important to train ourselves to turn away from our obsessive loops, our thinking, and enter a still place that's relatively thoughtless. And if we can do that when we're calm and life is okay, we can do it when life becomes more challenging and difficult. And so our relationship to the big mind, to Buddha nature, the unmoving place at the core of our consciousness, that is the domain of merit. See, we're talking about blessings are whether you get the raise or not because your boss saw you working hard, right? Or whether an editor liked the article you submitted to the journal. That's blessings. But our relationship to big mind is merit, right? And that means that if we spend very little time on the cushion doing zazen, we don't become very good at finding our true nature, right? We are still lost wandering around in causes and conditions. But the more we sit, the more intimately connected and aware we become of the unmoving. So that at times, even in the midst of chaos, we can suddenly focus on Buddha nature, or mushin. And when we do that, everything around, it's like the world can be swirling around us in chaos, but we're grounded and focused and alive and often unafraid. So this is the realm of merit. If we live for blessings, we're going to be turning on the burning wheel, We do our best, but it's capricious, it's unpredictable, and so on. So you know, do your best. We all have to ride the burning wheel on the wheel, do your best, but don't internalize it. Realize, you know, the good things, a lot of the good things in my life, actually, I didn't control, and the bad things I don't control either, you know? So I'm not going to become attached to the wheel, to the burning wheel, and to causes and conditions, good ones or bad ones. I'm going to cultivate my relationship with the Dharmakaya, with Buddha nature, with the unmoving. So this is really, I think, this is what gave Bodhidharma the ability to deal with the defeat he experienced when he went to meet Emperor Wu of Liang. You know, this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and he, you could say he blew it, but he didn't blow it. The emperor wasn't ready to hear what Dhammo had to say, what Daruma had to say. Daruma always told the truth from his heart, and the emperor was a good man, but he wasn't ready. So we would say karmic conditions weren't right for a meeting of minds. See, karmic conditions weren't right. And Bodhidharma left, and the emperor was told by another monk, you know, that was a great master of the Buddha's way, you know, great, deeply, he's the embodiment of Kanon, the embodiment of Guanyin. He's the embodiment of compassion. But, you know, they weren't ready to hear. He wasn't ready to hear that. So Bodhidharma left, and actually the emperor continued to do very good things. He was a good man. He just didn't understand Dhammo's teaching. He didn't understand Daruma's words. So, you know, if Bodhidharma had said, oh my gosh, you know, I've missed my chance. Now it's all downhill. I'm going to be living in a cave. What chance will I have to spread Zen? You know, he would have been caught in illusion. So instead, he grounded himself in the unmoving. He went to near Shaolin, and he found a cave. There was no Shaolin at that time, but he was there near what later became Shaolin, and he sat in a cave for 9 years, living with the unmoving, facing a wall, Pi Kuan, that's a wall stair. And he literally sat in front of a stone wall, but he was really sitting in front of the wall of Mu, confronting his true nature, his Buddha nature. And he sat there for 9 years, and peasants and farmers and country people would bring him food. But little by little, students showed up. You know, two men and a woman showed up, and they were very worthy, right? They could hear him. There was what we call karmic compatibility. His words and their understanding fit together. Right? Those two men and that woman made Zen possible in China. I think that this is what Liu Zhenhuang also knew. You know, Liu had experienced many defeats in his life. You know, at one point he, after his exile from the capital, he was living in a Zen temple, a Buddhist temple. He has a beautiful, beautiful poem about getting up early in the morning and reciting the sutras in the cold air. Beautiful. And he had many defeats, but he kept going back, not just to the temple, but to that place. He understood, you know, how to ground himself in the unmoving. And of course, this is what Matsu is trying to make Obaku understand, right? He's trying to help Obaku see. Obaku's still a young monk. And, you know, a wild duck comes by and he says, it's here and now it's gone. And in the world of causes and effects, that's true. Something can be here and something can be gone. In the world of blessings, something can be here and something can be gone. Something can be won and something can be lost, and so on. But in the world of merit, there is no coming and going. There is nothing to be attained. And this is what Matsu wants Obaku, Basso wants Yakujo to understand. So what happens when you encounter that? See, when you encounter that? Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I was planning to read another koan, but I won't do it because this has gone on for a long time. But there's a wonderful koan called Tipping Over a Water Bottle. And it involves a monastery where there was a student of Yakujo. So this is many years later. Basso is dead. Yakujo is an old man, and he's teaching Chan. He's teaching Zen, and he has a student named Isan, and Isan is working in the kitchen as the tenzo, or tienzo. And he's a head cook, in other words. And there's a number one monk who's not working in the kitchen. And everybody expects the number one monk to be Yakujo's Dharma heir. So anyway, Yakujo announces to the whole congregation, the whole temple. He says, we're opening a new temple in the West, and I need to find a capable leader for that community. And he said, here's the test. I'm going to put this bottle down on the ground. It's like a vase, he would say. And he said, I will nominate as head or appoint as head of the new monastery whoever can respond to this in the best way. So he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor, and he said, you may not call it a water bottle. What do you call it? That's the test. It's a koan, right? So he says, the most advanced student will open the new monastery. I'm going to put this water bottle on the ground, and he says, what do you call it? You cannot call it a water bottle. And the head monk, the one who everybody thinks of as the top monk, says, it cannot be called a tree stump. And then Yakujo says to Isan, well, what would you say? And Isan gets up and he kicks the bottle over, see? He kicks it over. And Yakujo says, oh, you're running the new monastery, okay, see? So, in other words, you know, gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. You know, if we don't worry about causes, as soon as we think about causes and conditions, we become paralyzed because there's so many permutations and possibilities we have to think about. You know, if I do this, this could happen. If I do that, this could happen. I might make this mistake, right? You know, if you believe that causes and conditions are the ultimate, if you are living for the blessings, then you'll be paralyzed, you know, or you won't be able to live fully, you could say. But if you live from the unmoving, if you trust in your Buddha nature, see, you don't care about causes and conditions. You're free from causes and conditions, which is certainly the way Wei Neng was. Wei Neng was free from causes. That's why Wei Neng was so amazing. Everybody who met him thought, this guy just doesn't, he's just not, he doesn't care about causes and conditions. It's his relationship to the big mind. It's his relationship to Buddha nature that motivates him. So Isan is like that. You know, he doesn't worry about right and wrong. He doesn't worry about consequences. He probably doesn't. I'm sure he doesn't care if he becomes head of the monastery or not. He's just acting freely from that place. So, you know, all of us make the mistake of taking seriously the absurd idea that we control the events of our life, as though we could foresee everything and all possibilities. And as though, you know, we can always look back and say, if I hadn't made this move and I'd made that one, everything would be, but nobody knew that in advance. You didn't know it. Nobody else does. It's a great turning wheel that no one can control. It's just the working out of karma as surely as Trump became president. You know, we don't control it. So please be aware of causes and conditions. Always be aware of causes and conditions, but don't personalize them. Don't believe they are who you really are or what you really are. They don't define you. Don't let them define you. Hyakujo and a wild duck. The universe is not veiled. All its activities lie open. Whichever way he goes, he meets no obstruction. At all times, he behaves independently. His every word is devoid of egocentricity, yet still has the power to kill others. Tell me, where did the ancient worthy come to rest? See the following. Main subject. When Matsu was out walking with Obaku, he saw a wild duck fly past. Matsu said, "What is it?" Obaku said, "A wild duck." Matsu said, "Where is it?" Obaku said, "It has flown away." Matsu at last gave Obaku's nose a sharp pinch. Obaku cried out with pain. Matsu said, "There, how can it fly away? It never flies away, never fails us, never fails us." Secho's verse, the wild duck, how and where? Basso has seen, talked, taught, and exhausted the meaning of mountain clouds and moonlight seas. But Joe doesn't yet understand, has flown away. Flown away? No. He is brought back. Say, say.